this is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak, and thank you very much for joining us again today for another edition of Midrats. Just a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you feel up to it, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find the chat room, which is a great place to roll in with the usual suspects. If you have some observations during the course of the show you'd like to make, or if you have some questions you'd like for us to ask our guests, because it doesn't like we're quite going in the direction you want us to, you put it in there, and we'll pick it up during the course of the show and do our best to fold it in as we go forward. Also, if you need to hop off and take care of business, and you want to catch up on what you missed, you can always get a full archive over Blog Talk Radio, or take the shortcut and just subscribe to the podcast over on iTunes. Now let's go ahead and get on with the core of the show. Up on the 18th of June, we have the bicentennial of the Battle of Waterloo, fought in present-day Belgium. And just in time for the bicentennial, we got just the right person today spend some time to look at the Napoleonic era of warfare, some things you may not have been aware of it, and more importantly, how those lessons apply today. It's Dr. John Kuhn. In his latest book he has out titled Napoleonic Warfare, the Operational Art of the Great Campaigns. In this book he covers an operational level analysis of European warfare running from 1792 to 1815. In his book, you're going to find a review of the tactics, the operations, and also the strategy of the major conflicts in that time. Or just a description of set piece battles taking place on land. John looks at naval warfare, maneuver warfare, compound warfare, something near and dear to everybody's hearts nowadays, counterinsurgency. John, he's a General William Scoff Chair of Historical Research at the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. He retired from the U.S. Navy in 2004, the rank of commander after 23 years of service as a naval flight officer in EP-3s and ES-3s. He's authored Agents of Innovation back in 2008, and he also co-authored Eyewitness Pacific Theater with another Midrats guest, DM Jim Greco, as well as numerous articles and editorials, and he was awarded the Mercado Prize from the Society of Military History back in 2011. More importantly, John, welcome back to Midrats.
Hey, thanks, Sal. Eagle One, good to talk to you guys.
Just to kind of set the scene for the rest of the show, there are literally libraries full of books about Napoleon and the wars in his period of time. And you come out with your book, you know, here in time for the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Waterloo. What will the reader find in your book they might not find elsewhere as kind of a one-stop shop?
Well, if he goes into chapter one, he'll realize right away he does not have the standard Napoleonic book in his hands. If he goes to chapter two, he might think as much if he starts with chapter two, he or she. But if they start with chapter one, they're going to realize pretty quick that this is not the standard book. There's something different going on here. I focus at the operational level of war for the most part, which means that the bulk of the book is operations and how that impacts strategy and political military strategies and outcomes. The book has got Napoleon's name on it, but it's not so much about Napoleon as it is about the warfare that got named after him. And the first, the first four chapters are really not, Napoleon's in there, but they discuss as much the stuff prior to him being Napoleon when he was just General Bonaparte. Okay, so what's different? the two models that I use for an operational analysis of the campaigns from 1792 to 1815, both on land and at sea, although the sea needs more, but we'll get into that later. But they're not used anywhere else. As far as I know, no one has ever used Soviet operational art theory as written by Svechin, Triandafilov, Tukhachevsky, and Isserson to analyze Napoleonic Wars. And I have to tip my hat to Dr. Jake Kipp. He kind of encouraged me to do that. I mentioned it to him, and he said, hey, you want to write a book on that? So I did. The other analytic framework is one that I learned when I was in the School of Advanced Military Studies back in the 90s at Fort Leavenworth, the so-called Jedi Knight preschool, SAMS, where the Jedi Knight Army Operational Planners are produced, who supposedly are the premier operational artists, or at least the premier operational planners in the American system. And there we had a theory instructor named Dr. Jim Snyder. And Snyder wrote up a really, really fascinating sort of kind of take on operational art. I didn't agree with when he thought it emerged. He thinks it emerged in the Civil War. And I talk a little bit about that in Chapter 1. But Snyder uses, and this is where my son told me, hey, I didn't know I was going to have to know about fluid dynamics. Yeah, so all you physicists and Naval Academy guys out there had to suffer through, you know, the basic STEM stuff. Yeah, I bring some of that into it. So Snyder uses a framework using distributed analysis and fluid dynamics and stuff like that for his discussion of elements of operational framework. So I've got this theory chapter up front that kind of explains these models, one of them really a historical model based on the Russian school, the Russian operational arts school, and then one that was created right here in the United States. So I defy anybody to find another book out there that uses a Soviet school and an American school on operational art to analyze Napoleonic Wars. Now, the stuff I analyze, yeah, there's been a zillion books written about it, and the guys that I tend to go with in terms of kind of relying on some of their ideas are pretty well known, and those books are out there already. But I'm not really critiquing David Chandler or Owen Conley or who's the other guy? Charles S. Dye. There's another one. Gates. There's David Gates. He's another big Napoleon. I'm not really critiquing them, but I do reference them here and there in the text. And Chandler is huge. So I can write more about all of this and put in the theory chapter into the book. I did have a bibliography. So if people want to see my sources, they have to go to the notes and figure out where the sources are. And so there's probably a lot of sources that contributed to the makeup of the book that don't make it into the notes. But if you go back to the notes section of the book, you'll go, I think so. And for the price of admission, there's an appendix with a translation of the Trachtenberg plan that I had translated by the French student. My professor kind of made a joke and said, hey, why don't you find this Trachtenberg plan that everybody talks about? I actually went back and found a document from 1815 with a French translation of the Trachtenberg Convention in it, and had the French student at CGSC in 1996, who was their major, Jean Parlant, he's probably a general now, translate that for me. I tried to give him some wine, but he said American wines were no good. So there you go. That's what's different about the book. No bibliography and two operational art frameworks that no one has ever used before. Although if somebody wants to correct me and give me citations, I'm ready.
Well, first, we got some comments already in the chat room about STEM and how that probably would have appealed to Napoleon. And I think, based on my readings, he was pretty much an early adopter of STEM stuff. He liked math, and he was pretty adept at it, I gather.
Yes, absolutely. Napoleon was an artillerist, and so you had to know how to do math to be in the artillery, which meant a lot of the French aristocracy avoided the artillery because it was too hard. Much easier to be in the cavalry or be in the infantry, but the artillery and the engineers both required people that knew, that had real skills, that had merit. And yeah, you did have to know kinematics in order to do to be in the artillery. And you had to know basic Newtonian physics to be in the engineers. So, yeah, Napoleon was a STEM guy.
Kind of a good lead-in to a question I wanted to look at is when you look at the chaos that came out of the French Revolution and the battles that were taking place in order to preserve the revolution, you know, here was this artillery officer from an obscure family in an obscure part of France itself. It rose eventually at one point to be the emperor, going from the Iberian Peninsula all the way up to Moscow. What was it about the way Napoleon conducted his operation so early on that gave him an opportunity to step into the power vacuum and just expand that?
Well, you're breaking up a little bit at your end, but thank God you kind of previewed that question to me. So we'll do a little comm check here. How am I coming in?
You sound good.
Coming in well. Hey, 5x?
Yeah, 5x.
Okay, yeah, you were like 3x3, you're not 5x5.
My apologies.
Oh, no sweat. I'm glad you told me the question ahead of time. All right. Sorry, gentle listeners, to let you peek behind the green curtain. So what was it about Napoleon? Well, first of all, let's just eliminate Napoleon from the discussion for a second. What was it about what the French did in reforms that made their army so difficult to subdue? Well, the first thing is they were the first European modern people in arms army. The levée en masse was by the great genius Carnot, the architect of victory, another STEM guy, by the way, a topo, an engineer. And Carnot and the members of the Committee on Public Safety mobilized the entire French people to fight. There's the famous levée en masse where, you know, that if you can't volunteer and fight in the armies, then you can stay behind and give speeches in the public square to inspire people. The children can stuff bullets with the gunpowder, and the women can make Band-Aids, and you know. And so they mobilized the entire state. It's a bit of a hyperbole, but the French mobilized the most populous, wealthiest nation in Western Europe to an extent that had never been done in modern Western Europe since maybe Roman times. So you get these 20 million, you know, energetic, active, you know, high testosterone Frenchmen backed by all the other French people that are women, and they put together these humongous armies. I mean, they almost mobilized 1 million men in arms in 1794. It was a feat of incredible magnitude. Not only that, but they already had the best artillery system in Europe, the famous Grubeval system, and so they had standardized artillery. And when the revolution occurred, the artillery probably lost the least amount of talent of all the services. So they were kind of like the Union Army in the Civil War. They had a really great artillery arm, a very, very effective artillery arm. They had some old generals that did not flee. They had some really young talent. And they had organizationally, they were already ahead of the rest of Europe because they created the Combined Arms Division. These things all existed before Napoleon commanded anything, before he even commanded an artillery company. So they're all there already, and then they're animated with this the patriotism, and they're yoked to this new ideology that the overthrow of monarchies and tyrants. So they've extremely powerful ideology, yoked to impressive organizational reforms, and this combined armed division with the best artillery in Europe, and oh by the way, more guys than anybody else in Europe, and Now, on the downside, they lost a lot of the goodness that comes with a professional, disciplined military. So they kind of did some ad hoc things. They said, well, if you don't know how to form up in line and do the manual of arms, you know, at least we'll teach you how to shoot a gun, and you're going to run around the battlefield and take pot shots at the enemy, and we'll call you a skirmisher, or as the French called them, voltigeurs, jumpers. So there's this extremely powerful way of war that's already present. And Napoleon is not the only one practicing. If you go to Chapter 4 in my book, you'll see that there's a number of other French generals who wield this form of warfare extremely effectively. And the French military machine is just this big, rambling, come-as-you-are, kick-ass organization. And it's got really good firepower with the artillery. And nobody knows what to do with it. They figure they'll just invade and all these peasants will throw down their arms, and they don't, because they're one of the most literate societies in Europe as well. So there's these real, and oh, by the way, more and more of them are learning to read every day because of the revolution. So it's a really difficult problem. And before long, the revolution expands. They're going to take that revolution and they're going to expand, into the neighboring areas and forward that revolution. How can these disorganized rabble, do this? How can they invade? And they don't have what's considered to be the peer competitor military. They have just a bunch of trucks and they take Mosul. Oops, wrong era. No, I mean, but the analogy is similar, which is it's a shock. That when you have this extremely powerful ideology, and then you yoke it to all these other things, that it does quite well. And by 1795, with Napoleon nowhere except down in Toulon in a side theater, helping chase the British from an overextended attempt to capture Toulon, the French defeat the Spanish and they defeat the Prussians. The Prussians signed the Treaty of Basel. And the Spanish signed the Treaty of San Sebastian. So before Napoleon even shows up on the scene, two of the great powers of Europe have already been defeated handily by these so-called amateur revolutionaries in France. And Britain and Austria are at their wits' end of how do we defeat these guys? Yeah, well, the easy way to defeat them is to just say, hey, we're not going to fight you anymore. Okay, let's just sign a peace treaty and go with the status quo, whatever it is now, But neither Great Britain is willing to sacrifice the Low Countries and neither is Austria, so there's a lot of political things. So that's the first thing. Napoleon inherits a very powerful military machine, and he doesn't really inherit it for another 5 years. So let's be honest about that. This is an extremely powerful French military machine. And it's got some very, very talented individuals in it, some of them from the French professional military education system, like Napoleon, like Davout, and others not. Others just sort of gifted savants, military savants, people like André Masséna and some of the other guys. There's one former actor, a guy named Saint-Cyr, Guillaume Saint-Cyr. He's an actor. He's like a stage guy. It's like Mick Jagger becoming a general. And he turns out to be an extremely gifted guy. And war does that, when you've got all these people. If you suck at being a general, the Committee of Public Safety sends out these guys called representatives on mission, and ISIS has nothing on these guys. These guys go out, and they kill the general. They go, you're fired, and literally, firing squad, dead. Okay, who wants to be the general now, And so eventually, you kind of cull out all the losers and you only get the best, most ideologically committed guys in command. So that's what happens. Now, what does Napoleon bring to the table? Well, the entire book on war by Clausewitz kind of deals with that, what Napoleon brings to the table. But two things Napoleon brings to the table is, one, he's a politician as well as a military professional. So he's an extremely good politician. He ends the War of the First Coalition in 1797 with a brilliant feat of political negotiating at Leoben in Austria. Sets up the grounds for the Treaty of Campo Formio, which ends the First War, except with Great Britain, which refuses to, which just simply cannot declare peace with France because so many of her interests are threatened by the revolution. So he brings that to the table with his political skills. He is a computer in a human body. He is one of the most efficient workaholic geniuses in history, a lot like his hero Frederick the Great and his other hero Caesar. He's a guy with an incredible capacity to write laws, to write treaties, to design a battalion, to design new artillery, to pick the... I mean, the guy is a workaholic genius, which is, I think, one of the reasons he dies so early. He's like Mozart. I mean, he just produces. It's just this constant work. He sleeps about 2 or 3 hours a day, usually a two-hour nap somewhere between 2 and 4 in the morning. But he's just got this incredible capacity for work that never leaves him his whole life. He slows down a little bit later in life, but even Napoleon, at his, you know, when we see him later when he's a little chubbier and a little bit more florid and everything, he still can outwork a lot of guys that we have around today. Just an incredible capacity for work. He's not French. He's Italian. His family is from Florence, and then they settle in Corsica, but Italian is his first language. So he's got this Corleone-type blood in him, you know. So he's a master at controlling people and manipulating. He's also the head of the family. He's the head of the Bonaparte family, even though he's not the number one brother. So the godfather applies in that respect. The most talented child of Letizia Bonaparte's many, many children rises to the top. And that's his great weakness, too, is he starts putting his brothers and sisters in charge, and they have nowhere near his level of talent. Only one of them comes close, and that's probably Lucien, who renounces Napoleon and the Napoleonic Empire before Napoleon's ever defeated later on. So he brings this ruthless capacity for work. Now, Napoleonic strategy. So Napoleon finds this beautiful military instrument, and like any efficient genius workaholic, he makes it better. He creates the Combined Arms Corps. He adds artillery he creates an operational reserve of artillery. So any army that he has got all this extra artillery that he can commit at key points in the campaign or the battle. He carries around giant amounts of cavalry for operational pursuits, and that's where I bring the Russian stuff in. The Russians do the same thing in the Polish-Russian War in 1921, and then, of course, in World War II with their deep battle and all that kind of stuff. So he makes all these improvements, not just to the military, but to the political system. I mean, the way France is organized today is absolutely because of Napoleon. The Code Napoleon, the concordance with the Catholic Church, the organization in the departments, all this stuff is Napoleonic. So just this incredible man, a lot like Caesar, a guy who could do it all. He was a jack of all trades, master of all trades. But he was very, very gifted at warfare. His type of warfare was very much that of an artillery officer. Where's the target? Load my biggest cannon and fire my biggest round at that target. And he creates a cannonball called the Grand Armée. It's an army group. It consists of 8 combined arms corps, plus an artillery reserve, plus a cavalry reserve. And then instead of dribbling this thing around the periphery of France to do all these different campaigns, he aims it at one target, and on the front of my book, he blows it to pieces. Now, tactically, Napoleon's not the greatest tactician ever. There's better tacticians than Napoleon on the battlefield. But operationally, Napoleon does what Clausewitz always recommends, which is the best strategy is to be strong everywhere. So whenever Napoleon shows up with his giant Grand Armée of 170,000 men, all of them, by the way, 10-year veterans of war, and he shows up, you know, with this thing, it's game over. And he can throw this thing down a line of operations several hundred kilometers long and still have enough combat power at the end to defeat 2 emperors at Austerlitz in, you know, the most godforsaken part of Central Europe in Moravia, you know, near this little town of Austerlitz. So his strategy is to take everything and put it into one main effort and then to obliterate whatever the biggest piece of military organization the enemy has. Now, this is a great state-on-state warfare tool. In counterinsurgencies, it's not so good. But Napoleon's the nation builder. That's really what gets him into problems as he conquers all these places. He tries to create new nations that look just like France in terms of their laws and their customs and everything. And he hates corruption and inefficiency. So if he runs into a corrupt or inefficient regime, it just goes against the grain of what he thinks is right. So he wants to eliminate it and completely rebuild it. This is what he tries to do in Spain. It just is a catastrophe. He tries to basically create in Spain another France, another Republican France, and it's a dismal failure. So he does overreach. And at one point, Napoleon the politician, who's very skilled and gifted, gives way to Napoleon the general. And every time Napoleon the politician runs into a political problem he can't solve, and oh, by the way, this is a David Chandler theme, he goes to Napoleon the general and says, bail me out with another war. And this works pretty good until 1812. And then he decides that he's going to deal with the Russian problem, the great problem of the East, which is, what do we do about this giant autocracy that wants to meddle in European affairs? Ha! Does that sound familiar? I think I've answered your question, but closing on that is, it's the problem that we're dealing today in Central and Eastern Europe with Russia is precisely the problem Napoleon was trying to deal with, and his solution was, find the Tsar's army and obliterate, and then make the Tsar come crawling to me on his knees. So that's probably enough, and we can have a lot of discussions about other stuff.
Well, one of the readings I did, there was a Hungarian officer after the Battle of Lodi who said, basically described Napoleon, here's a young man who knows nothing, absolutely nothing of the rules of war. Today's on our rear, tomorrow on our flank, next day on our front. Such violations of the principles of the art of war are intolerable. And it really set up to, for me, that he did revolutionize warfare in a lot of ways. And can you kind of discuss what the art of war was before he came along, and what, he had this, as you said, this sort of go for the strategic, most strategic target, I guess, is the right way to describe it. But what was it before, and what did he bring to it other than, you know, mobility and sudden overwhelming force applied to critical points and all that stuff?
Well, he brought the most populous nation of France to it, or the most populous nation in Europe to it, is what he brought to it. And that was a real problem for everybody else. France had always had this kind of power as being the most populated, well-organized nation in Europe. That had happened under Louis XIV, but again, she overreached, and she ended up running into some other geniuses in Austria and Great Britain, Marlborough and Prince Eugene of Savoy. So he had sort of the same thing, but on a much, much bigger scale. His techniques, he claimed, he learned a lot from Frederick. When he counter-invaded Prussia. Remember, Prussia in 1806 invaded Napoleon's allies in Germany, not vice versa. So when Napoleon, counterattacked and conquered Prussia, he went to Berlin and he visited the tomb of Frederick the Great and to honor Frederick the Great. So Frederick was one of his heroes, and he really studied Frederick's campaigns. He was also a very, very close student of Caesar's campaigns, but Frederick was really his role model when it came to sort of operational art. But he exceeded the master, but he brought a very well organized, highly populated, nation behind him to the thing. And the nation of France, one time he said, La France et moi, just as Louis said, l'état et moi. Napoleon said, France is me and I am France. And he was right about that all the way to 1814, the French people underwrote him. Now, there were a lot of draft dodgers as time went on, but even near the end, it was incredible what he could do against every nation in Europe is invading France, and Napoleon's fighting on interior lines, keeping them at bay. And that's because he knew how to keep the main thing. He knew how to judge a situation, and he knew he had what I call strategic killer. He knew how to kind of ignore the minor shit and do the major stuff, excuse my language. But he was really good at that. He was also very good, and this is where the operational art piece comes in, at improvising. Moltke later said that, you know, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. And if you read about Napoleon, you're like, so where's his plans? He only had very, very general plans. And his plans were based on, okay, what's the enemy going to do? And then I'll make up my mind. Oh, the enemy is going to disperse his forces along do a barrier defense. Oh, okay, well, I'll just find the weakest point and I'll slam through there with 200,000 men. And that was kind of what he did. Owen Conway, I think, gets Napoleon's operational method correct, which is to kind of scramble your way to victory. I'll just kind of go into Prussia with this giant army with a footprint of about, you know, 500 square kilometers, and I'll bump into the enemy somewhere, and I'll use intelligence and reconnaissance, and when I figure out what his main force is, I'll just obliterate it. And that's what he did. He was really good at that. Occasionally, he had his tactical masterpiece is Austerlitz, but he was very good at deception, both tactically and at operational deception. But some of his battles are not very elegant. Frederick the Great sometimes fought more elegant battles than Napoleon did. Napoleon's troops had great tactics and everything, but they could be defeated tactically. The Austrians, the Russians, and the British all knew how to best the French tactically on a battlefield, but it doesn't matter much if you've got a giant core across your line of communications cutting off your line of retreat and advancing into your rear or on your flank. And the general, I think, that you mentioned, the Austrian, I think that's Kray, General Kray, who was himself quite a good general. Napoleon didn't recognize any rules of war. He regarded himself as the expert on war, so he didn't pay any attention to anybody's rules. When warfare, the chapter that really kind of explains what happened, why did Napoleon fail so catastrophically in Russia, is the Napoleonic Total War. That's chapter 7. And war had gotten so big that not even Napoleon could kind of constrain it and contain it. Whenever he was there personally, he did quite a good job. You know, he was only defeated tactically a couple of times, and one of them being, of course, at the Battle of Mont Saint-Jean, which is Waterloo. By the way, today is the famous invasion at Charleroi, where Wellington reputedly said that he's buggered me, because Napoleon hit the juncture between Wellington's army and Blücher's army at its weakest. Remember what I said about the barrier defense? It's what the Prussians and the British were doing. The British were kind of protecting their lines of communication to the Channel, and the Prussians were protecting their lines of communication back to the Meuse and the Rhine. And Napoleon hit them at their weakest point at Charleroi and just erupted in the worst possible place for the British and the Prussians. And so he was really good at that. He was very good at kind of figuring out where his enemies had made a mistake and just punishing them to no end for that mistake. The problem was he didn't know how to make a lasting peace. And that's kind of our problem today, isn't it?
One of the other challenges we have here is working with coalitions. And when people look at the little set piece maps of the Battle of Waterloo, you see your little French flags here and there, but on the other side, you see British, you see a variety of German states, you see the Prussians, you see the Dutch forces, the coalition. But Napoleon also fought with coalition partners of varying degrees of volunteering to be that. What characteristics of coalition warfare during the Napoleonic Wars, and how does that compare and contrast to our coalition experience, especially since 9/11?
Well, Napoleon couldn't hold a candle to the U.S. military tradition of coalitions, at least in the 20th century. Napoleon was not a very good coalition warrior. His most successful campaigns as sort of a coalition commander were in 1805, 1806, and sort of in 1809. The Russian campaign, it was really a coalition European army that he led against the Russians. But, you know, I mean, Victor Hugo in Les Miserables, his famous chapters on Napoleon early in the book, he makes the point at some point he spilled too much blood that belonged to other people, and finally alienated all of his other partners. And they were always junior partners. Napoleon's allies, on the other hand, you know, by the time we get to Waterloo, it's the War of the Eighth Coalition. You know, and the French made fun of coalition warfare. They say, well, coalitions suck, you know. If you treat your coalition partners as equals, then you're going to have to compromise, and compromise always waters everything down, and you can't get nobody can agree on everything. And so coalitions they're a hindrance. You don't want to avoid coalitions. Don't go to war with coalitions. Go to war, you know, just go to war. You get unity of command. You get this, you can avoid this unity of effort and all this politicking. But the Europeans got better and better and better at coalition warfare the more they fought Napoleon. And Napoleon, you know, he really kind of screwed the pooch when it came to coalitions. You know, at one point he was allied to Austria. Another point he was allied to Prussia, although that alliance was, the Prussians were forced into it. They never wanted it. Clausewitz resigned his commission and went to the Russian army when that happened. And was regarded by a traitor by the king for the rest of his life for it, even though the king eventually reinstated him to the Prussian army. But it's one of the reasons that Clausewitz was sort of you know, marginalized. But the Allies became better and better coalition partners as the wars went on. And by 1813, they were really good at coalition warfare. And Wellington in the peninsula, he was the penultimate coalition commander for a, you know, compound hybrid force of guerrillas, Portuguese, French, and British, and the British forces not only included the British, but they included a lot of Germans. So Wellington was very, very good at coalition warfare. And Napoleon's other opponents, the Austrians, the Russians, and the Prussians, were initially horrible at coalition. They got better and better and better, and by the time Napoleon got to Waterloo, he's facing a coalition of all of Europe again, just like he did in 1813. And this time he's only got, you know, less than 250,000 men, and he's facing a coalition that's got more than 2 million men under arms and, you know, almost 200,000 men in the theater there in Belgium, with Napoleon with only about 120,000 against them. And what's unfortunate for Napoleon is he goes again, yeah, he looks around and he goes, what's the biggest force that I can destroy the quickest? Well, it's the army group, if you will, although I say in my epilogue that Blücher and Wellington remind one more of Marlborough and Eugene in the wars against Louis XIV than they do of Napoleonic warfare. But these are the two guys that are the best at coalition of warfare on the Allied side. Blücher, who was very good, very good coalition partner in 1813 and 1814, with the best chief of staff, you know, in existence at the time, a guy named Gneisenau. Napoleon's great chief of staff is dead, Berryer. And Gneisenau, and close friends with Clausewitz. Clausewitz is at Wavre, which is a battle that's a rearguard action against an entire French army. But Gneisenau is the chief of staff. So you've got these two great coalition commanders that Napoleon goes up against at Waterloo, and he can't win. These two guys are too cooperative. They've got too much experience of kind of figuring out how to do it, and there's trust there, and Napoleon doesn't have any allies precisely because he doesn't trust his allies to do what they're supposed to, and when they screw up, he yells at them, and, you know. And so the lessons here for us since 9/11 is, you know, we in Afghanistan, we just kind of said, well, let's let the coalition do it, and then we'll go do Iraq with a coalition of the willing, but there's really the United States and everybody else is sort of like, you know, junior partners, and we're the senior partner. That's a problem. You know, the best that we've done since then is probably Libya, and that's because of Robert Gates. It said, you know what, these guys kind of do coalition warfare without us as the lead nation. You know, we're trying to do that in Korea, and without us being such a, you know, huge senior partner to the Koreans. So I would say, you know, since Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and we were still the senior partner in that one too, by the way, you know, I wouldn't give us high marks for coalition warfare. I'd give us relatively low marks for coalition warfare. But, you know, if you go back to World War I and World War II, particularly World War II, But, you know, World War II, that's just one data point. Name me another war where we did as well in coalition warfare as World War II. I mean, even in World War I, we were an associated power. We were like, you know, we're not really part of the alliance against the Germans, you know. You're the guys that started this flipping war, not us, you know. So, yeah, we'll fight against the Germans because we want to end this war, but we really don't like you people. And then when we got to the, you know, peace conference afterwards, it was everybody ignored us, you know, like, eh, you know, you don't want to play ball? We won't play ball. We'll do whatever we want with the Treaty of Versailles. You know, oh, we'll do the League of Nations, you know, and then we don't even join that. So, you know, Wilson didn't get anything he wanted. So, this, you know, are we great coalition warriors? Well, we did pretty good in World War II, and the Cold War was a fairly successful case study in coalition warfare with the United States as sort of the senior partner. You know, it'd be interesting to see a study of the Russians. I think the Russians made the same mistake that we made, that we've been making. I said, they're sort of the senior partner, you know, and if you don't do it their way, then, you know, they beat you up and they belittle you, you know. So is it any wonder that none of those nations really, you know, wanted to use their armies to maintain the Soviet Empire, you know, in 1989? No accident at all that they were all kind of like, yeah, bye-bye, Russia. You know, you can go your way. You know, go your own way. Yeah, Fleetwood Mac. But, yeah, I don't think much of our coalition efforts since 9/11. I really don't. I think we had some good systems in place and everything, and I think NATO could be a good coalition, but I think we gotta pull the tit back. Sorry for that metaphor.
Let's talk a little bit about Napoleonic Navy and his view of naval power. I mean, he was obviously up against the Royal Navy, which was the power of the day, but the French were no weak sisters at sea.
Oh yeah, the sea chapter is there because all too often, you know, I make my point, which is, you know, Napoleon has an army of the people. They are France's army. Now they become Napoleon's army, but it's really the army of France, and they're fighting for France. And Napoleon never just says it's for me. He always says it's for France and the fatherland. It's for me and the fatherland. It's for the patrie. Where's your, you know? So he's incredible about doing that. Britain has the world's first national navy. And everybody has commented on this, but I comment on it too, which is, you know, that signal at Trafalgar is England expects every man to do his duty. Not George expects every man to do his duty. Not the king expects every man to do his duty, but England expects every man to do his duty. So England, just as France develops this national army during the Wars of the Revolution, Britain has already developed over the previous 100 years, and Mahan comments on this, as do most naval historians, they've already developed a meritocracy with an extremely well-organized navy, with a system of advancement which is based on merit and service to the country, and it is Britain's first line, as any maritime nation. You know, the Navy in Great Britain is the senior service. It's the honorable service, you know. The loser second and third sons go into the Army, not going to the Navy. Oh, by the way, the aristocrats often don't make it in the Navy because they can't do things like celestial navigation and figuring out dead reckoning and doing math and stuff like that. So a lot of the Navy is, you know, there's a lot of lords and aristocrats in the Navy, but a lot of them are like Napoleon's aristocrats. They're made aristocrats because of their merit in their profession as naval officers. So now, why couldn't France have done that at sea? Well, one, she is up against the best Navy, and oh, by the way, it's very difficult to have the world's greatest army and the world's greatest Navy. Knock, knock, knock. Hello, McFly, United States. Have you figured that one out yet? You can't. It's pretty hard to have the greatest army and the greatest navy, never mind the greatest flipping air force now. So, and Napoleon wanted to have the greatest navy, and he thought maybe his brother Jerome would be the Napoleon of the seas. And he went into the Royal Navy, and first thing Jerome did when he got to Baltimore was go on shore leave and marry Elizabeth Patterson. That's why Charles Bonaparte was Secretary of the U.S. Navy. Elizabeth Patterson refused to renounce her Bonaparte name when the Pope annulled the marriage. But so the French tried to have a navy, and Clark Reynolds does a magnificent job in his book, Command of the Sea, showing how the French tried to build that navy back up, and they had some very good naval officers. Latouche Trevis, the guy that's in command prior to the Treaty of Amiens and who destroys Nelson's commando raid on Boulogne in 1801, I think. A very, very good officer, and he had the right idea to use a fleet and being approach to challenge the British Navy. But Napoleon didn't understand that. He thought navies could be thrown around the way armies could be thrown around. And David Chandler says it best. He says he never understood the subtleties of war at sea, of tides, and coming in on the tide, going out on the tide, so you couldn't just order people to march with a navy. And communications, very, very, very difficult. Even though Napoleon, I argue, sort of exercised a type of mission command in his army, the British Navy is an entirely mission command organization, and I bring that up in my chapter on Artists of the Waves. And it's not just Nelson. Everybody always thinks it's Nelson. It's the Nelson system, as then they have said after the Battle of Trafalgar. At Trafalgar, every British captain was a Nelson. And that's not far from wrong. The British just had excellent, excellent naval officers. Nelson is killed at the beginning of the battle. So if it's all about Nelson, they lose Trafalgar, right? No, they win. And they keep on winning, and because they have guys like Hood and Black Dick Howell and Lord St. Vincent and Rodney and all these guys and Cuthbert Collingwood, Nelson's second in command at Trafalgar, and the guy who actually ends up kind of taking over when Nelson is shot. So yeah, you always got to be ready to fleet up, right, Sal? So the British Navy is a people's navy, and the French are really, either they're going to build up a big navy and they're going to challenge British that way, but they've got this problem. It's called a land frontier with other continental powers. That's the good news for your audience, by the way, which is the good news is Russia has a long, long, long land frontier with other continental powers. And then China's even worse off with an even longer, almost as long, continental. And who's on her borders? North Korea with nuclear weapons, Pakistan with nuclear weapons, India with nuclear weapons, Russia with nuclear weapons, and then these crazies in Afghanistan and all these other places. So there's all, did you know China borders Afghanistan? Yes, they do. So, Vietnam, they're real friendly, aren't they? So is China going to have the biggest navy and the biggest army? Great. Do it, China. You'll go down in flames.
From the American perspective, the big war of the 19th century was the U.S. Civil War. And a lot of people have looked at the extreme amount of bloodshed that there was during the American Civil War. It was not so much the fact civil wars are usually very, very bloody, but the fact that the American professional military class really, really studied and took the Napoleonic era to heart without fully accounting for how technology had changed and made the battlefield even more bloody. Is that a valid critique? And what was some of the aspects of Napoleonic warfare that at the eve of the U.S. Civil War really was soaked into the U.S. armies and eventually the Confederate Army's officer class?
Well, it's not unique to the United States. The Austro-Franco War in the late 1850s, the Crimean War, they're bloodbaths. And so people realize that the battlefields become immensely lethal. I mean, the Napoleonic Wars and the Wars of the French Revolution, they introduce a level of lethality on the battlefield that was unprecedented as well. So you see this sort of exponential advance in firepower with every generation, and sometimes several exponential increases in firepower, which is what happened in World War One. And whenever that happens, usually the defense has got the edge. So you get these incredible losses, as you try to use sort of what worked in the previous war to achieve, your objectives in the current war. And U.S. officers before the Civil War studied not just Napoleonic tactics at the feet of Dennis Hart Mahan, A.T. Mahan's father, but they also studied the siege warfare stuff, So they were very familiar with both siege warfare as well as with maneuver warfare. So I don't think they get credit for that. And actually, now that I think about it, I don't think that point has been made often enough. It is made by some military historians out there. On top of it, you're going to do this with armies of conscripts, just like the French did, right? Well, what happened with the French when they went out there with these armies of conscripts with all this firepower? But now it's not, now they're fairly two equally matched forces. But the geographic scale here is just incredible. And probably the guy who understood what was really involved with the war better than anybody else was Winfield Scott, the designer of the Anaconda plan. But, nobody wanted to do the Anaconda plan because it was going to take time. And everybody thought, no, we'll have that one Austerlitz or that Jena Auerstadt, and that'll be it, right? We'll have Bull Run, and the Yankees will go, we surrender. The problem is that you've really got two Frances fighting each other. You've got two ideologically committed states fighting it out. I tend to look at the Civil War not so much as sort of it's really the War of the Rebellion, but it's not a civil war in the classic sense where each town has got its faction. And so everywhere, everybody's fighting. No, it's really two states, the northern state and the southern state. And the politicians part of the Civil War are really responsible for that by kind of letting the South be a nation within a nation. The problem is it was going to kill the body politic of the overall nation. With the Dred Scott decision, slavery was going to be legal everywhere. And there's nothing you could do. The Missouri Compromise and the Nebraska Act, none of that stuff was going to solve the problem. So you have these two committed ideologies that are against each other. Now, one of them is, let's face it, we're going to maintain slaveocracy in the South with the thin veneer of states' rights over the top. And in the North, the ideology is the Union. And maybe we'll get rid of slavery, but, if we can bring them back into the Union and they're willing to abide by the Constitution, which allows us to elect whoever we want for president, and we just don't get the red ass and leave the Union when the president we don't like gets elected, then so you have these two very powerful ideologies. Well, when that happens, nobody's going to agree to one battle. Look at the Japanese. Did they quit after the Battle of Midway? Uh-uh. In fact, they even kind of said, just a flesh wound. That's what they said to themselves. Seriously, Sal. The Japanese Navy said, it's not as bad as we thought it was, we'll still beat them, Oh, look, they stuck their head into a meat grinder at Guadalcanal. We'll beat the crap out of them down there. So these two committed ideologies. Well, and then you've got all these draftees, and you're using Napoleonic columns and lines, which that's about the best that you can do. And even the lines are hard to do. And I mean, they even train these armies up for almost a year before they really get committed to battle in the East and in the West. And then they bumble into each other in just the most ferocious terrain. It's incredibly hard to feed these large armies. So you can't go very far from a railroad or from a river, or the army's going to starve. We get a whole Confederate army basically starving as it strikes out across the wilds of Arkansas in 1864 to try to reclaim Missouri, So these armies are going to starve, or they've got to be small, and if they're small, they're not going to get much done, so they got to be big. So you get these catch-22s. So you end up with a war of attrition between these two committed ideologies. We're just going to fight this grimly until we put this down. We have to have regime change in Richmond, and actually we have to have regime change in every single state in the South. And so that's what happens. Now, in war, as our friend Carl says, nothing is ever final. And so after the Civil War ends and all that blood is and everything and the Union is reestablished, the South begins its counterinsurgency strategy, which it succeeds at, and it retains the political objectives of apartheid in the United States. And so the Civil War goes all the way to 2008, as far as I'm concerned. That's when the counterinsurgency is finally killed. But, yeah, it's very bloody because of Napoleonic tactics. It's still going to be very bloody. So my argument is, so what? It's still going to be bloody. William Tecumseh Sherman is regarded as a lunatic. he gets put in command in the West after Bull Run, which he did very good at. He commanded division at Bull Run. He gets out into the West, gets to Louisville, I think, either Louisville or Cincinnati, takes a look at the scope of the challenge facing, and he says, this war is going to take 2 or 3 years, and I need 150,000 men in my theater. And everybody thinks he has a nervous breakdown. He doesn't have a nervous breakdown. He does a good assessment of the situation and calls it like it is, which is this is going to be a protracted war, and it's going to require a lot of troops. Nobody wants to hear that, you know. Nobody wants to hear that this is going to take, you know, 20 years. And, oh, by the way, is it worth it? You know, there's the famous quotation after the war's over. You know, if I'd have known it was going to cost this much blood, I would have said to my southern compatriots, go your way, erring sisters.
Well, we're
I think I answered your question.
Yeah, you got it.
Don't get me started on the Civil War. I have very strong opinions.
We're coming up on the 200th anniversary of Waterloo, and I guess the questions that, I mean, there's so many factors involved, the weather, the late arrival, but the still timely arrival of the Prussians and all that stuff. What if you were advising Napoleon today about Waterloo, what would you tell him? You got about 3 minutes left in the show, so where would you go with that?
Okay, so Napoleon flees the island of Elba, and he flees for very good reasons. I tend to go with the revisionist historians, or maybe they're the revisionist historians, that the Bourbons in France wanted Napoleon dead. They wanted him dead. He had murdered one of their family, the Duc d'Enghien, judicially murdered him. He had embraced the revolution. He stood for everything they hated, and they wanted him dead. So, and the Austrians and the Russians, as time went on, they were like less and less inclined to keep their promises, because, you know, states don't behave like moral people. They're amoral entities. So, you know, states don't have friends. States have interests. And Napoleon was no friend to Russia or Austria. So Napoleon decides to do, you know, the 100 days, and he leaves Elba, and because it's being misgoverned, you know, the Bourbons are making all the mistakes that inbred monarchists make. And so Napoleon seizes the government with sort of a velvet revolution. It's kind of the Orange Revolution of its day, you know. There's very little violence, and the king flees as his minister. So some of Napoleon's generals who'd switch sides, so some of them stay. And then he puts, hey, that's all I want, France, you know, borders of 1789, you know, status quo, antebellum. I'll stay behind, you know, the Sambre River. I'll stay behind the Alps. I'll stay north of the Pyrenees, you know, just let me be president of France. And the Allies say, no way. You know, most populous nation on earth with the military genius as the chief executive, we don't buy it for a minute. We just got finished with 23 years of warfare, and you want us to, you know, give you a pass. No, we're not going to do it. At that point, my advice, that's when I would give Napoleon some advice. I'd say, hey, Napoleon, come here for a second, buddy. Come over here. Let me talk to you, okay? Okay. It's not working out. All right, you know, why don't you just go down to, you know, to Brest and take your Polish mistress and your son and get on that thing and go to the United States and, you know, maybe bring Jerome with you and he can be reunited with his American wife and set up shop in Baltimore. That's what I would tell him. He's not going to win. He is not going to win. Blücher has 120,000 troops. Wellington has 110,000 troops. Napoleon only has 120,000 troops. Behind Blücher and Wellington marching through the Vosges Mountain is a coalition of Austrian and Russian and Bavarian and Württembergish and every other German state you can think of, army of about 250,000. And then there's another Russian army of nearly 500,000 men and more Austrian reserves mobilizing. The Spanish have mobilized, and they're mobilizing. Oh, by the way, because of Napoleon, they now have an army that's worth a shit, and the Portuguese are mobilizing, and because of Wellington, they have an army that's worth a shit. And so it's a huge mess, and even Napoleon's former territories in Italy, which were some of his most loyal territories, because Napoleon was, after all, spoke Italian from birth, not French. Even they are like, well, Napoleon, we're going to sit this one out. So he's never going to win at Waterloo. There's no way he's going to win. So, yeah, he makes Wellington get off his little hill there before Brussels. Big deal. Big deal. Okay, who's up next? Oh, a 500,000 man army, you know. And, you know, even if he pushes Wellington off of the thing, he's still got Blücher with 80,000 troops on his flank. So what happens the next day, you know? Thielmann's corps with Clausewitz as chief of staff arrives to reinforce Blücher. Oh, by the way, Wellington was no dum-dum. He had a corps of another 19,000 troops over at Hals ready to reinforce him if he got pushed back by Napoleon. And Napoleon certainly didn't have the operational reserves like he had in previous campaigns to do an operational pursuit. He wasted his cavalry, or Ney wasted his cavalry, or somebody wasted his cavalry on the day of Waterloo in those magnificent but fruitless charges against the British squares.
Well, we have used up your time, John. I want to thank you for being here with us today. We could go on. I think most books of Napoleon last more than an hour to read, and I suspect we could go for several more days on this topic.
Yeah. No. I'd tell Napoleon, hey, you know, quit while you're ahead. You know, you got this really sweet Polish countess, you know, and they'll take you in the United States. I think the British would have escorted him over there, to be honest. You know,
well, he was trying to run, wasn't he?
Captured. After Waterloo, he tried to do just that. Yeah. He tried to get on a. He went down. There was a British ship. I forget whether it was Le Havre or where it was, Brest or wherever it was. One of the Channel ports. Maybe it was what's that other one? Not Dunkirk. What's the other one that's up there? But anyway, he went up to one of those Channel ports, and there was a British ship there, and he said, "Hey, I throw myself at your mercy." Because the one nation that he trusted not to commit judicial murder was Great Britain.
Hmm. No,
and
he was right.
He said, take me to the United States. And the British said, no, we're not taking the United States. We don't like those guys. We're still fighting a war with them. Or we just fought a war with them, too. We're not letting you go be with them. We like Canada, and we want it to remain in the Queen's domains or the King's domains.
Other than this book, which I think sounds like a tremendous addition to everybody's Napoleonic library, what can we look forward to in the next few weeks?
Buy it for your friends. Get it into Costco. I want it in Costco.
me too. So what else you got going on that we can look forward to?
Well, I think next up will be I've got a paper I'm going to present at Annapolis in the fall. It's about how the General Board helped the Navy prepare for World War One. And everybody always says that the United States wasn't prepared for World War One, and that's a load of nonsense. In fact, because we were prepared, the German U-boat campaign was defeated. So, but that's not what my paper's going to be about. It's actually going to be about war planning and what we were doing and walking the thin line between neutrality and belligerency with the Germans and with the other allies. The other thing that I just had something posted on Tom Rick's blog about appeasement, talking about today, you know, with Russia in the Ukraine and China in the South China Sea. And so that's up on Tom Rick's blog. I think it got published on Thursday. Other than that, I keep sending in these essay contests, essays to the United States Naval Institute. One of these days, I hope to win a prize or something. But other than that, I think I'm going to do counter-landing operations in the Ryukyus using the Marine Corps or something like that to defeat the Chinese hordes when they try to capture our cruise missile sites in Okinawa or something. So anyway, those are some ideas that I'm kicking around. I have my book on America's First General Staff that I'm trying to finish. It's you know how James Garner, you know, in Shakiest Gun in the West or whatever, he says, I've always wanted to go to Australia. I'm going to finish this book on the General Board, I swear. You know, it's my that'll be written on my tombstone, you know.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you being with us today, and look forward to hearing more. I would really like to get a look at that presentation you're going to do to the Naval Academy. But Anyway, we got to let you go, and thanks a lot for being with us today, and I guess happy 200th anniversary of Waterloo, and happy
Flag Day. Yeah, vive l'Empereur. Yeah, long live the Emperor.
All right, John. Thanks,
okay,
thanks,
so.
Thanks a lot.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
See you there, Equal One. Bye.
Bye.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.